Today is Monday, May 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Iranian state television says Tehran has reached a deal with Washington to free prisoners in exchange for billions of dollars. But
State Department spokesman Ned Price says simply, reports that a prisoner swap deal has been reached are not true.
Plus, another deadly attack in Afghanistan by Taliban insurgents as the international community tries to get all sides back to the negotiation table. We'll have these stories and more next. The United States is denying a report on Iranian state television that Tehran has reached a deal with Washington and Britain to free prisoners with Western ties in exchange for billions of dollars in new economic aid. The AP's Ben Thomas starts us off.
برخی منابع از آزادی 4 زندانی ایرانی و دریافت 7 میلیارد دلار.
Citing unidentified sources, Iran state television reported what it described as 4 American spies would be swapped for 4 Iranian prisoners and $7 billion. State TV is run by hardliners, and the report comes amid a power struggle between hardliners and the relatively moderate government of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, raising the prospect the report was intended to disrupt talks in Vienna on resuscitating Iran's nuclear deal with world powers. State Department spokesman Ned Price says simply, reports that a prisoner swap deal has been reached are not true. While President Biden's chief of staff Ron Klain tells CBS's Face the Nation the U.S. is working very hard to get the Americans released, but so far there's no agreement. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Gasoline tanker trucks burst into flames in Kabul, Afghanistan overnight, killing at least 7 people, injuring more than a dozen, and causing power cuts to parts of the Afghan capital. Reuters' Maha Al-Badrawi is up next.
An eyewitness described fleeing after 3 back-to-back explosions caused huge fires to break out, and returning home the next morning to find their windows and doors shattered. The cause of ignition was not immediately known, but the fires come as the city remains on high alert, with officials bracing for attacks from the insurgent Taliban over foreign troops' continued presence in the country. The Taliban have said U.S. President Joe Biden's announcement last month that American troops would leave by September 11th violates a 2020 agreement under the Trump administration that offered a May 1st withdrawal deadline. 2 security sources had earlier told Reuters they believed the fire was caused by a Taliban rocket fired in the area. However, Taliban spokesperson Zabihullah Mujahid has said they were not involved. A separate shooting incident on Saturday in Kandahar prompted the commander of foreign forces in Afghanistan to warn that attacks on foreign troops would be a mistake and that they would defend themselves and Afghan forces if needed.
Maha Al-Badrawi reports for Reuters News. Abdullah Abdullah is the chairman of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation. He discussed the implications of the U.S. and NATO withdrawal on Afghanistan's peace process with VOA's Aisha Tanzim.
Should Taliban choose to increase violence with the hope that they can take advantage of that situation, that's a possibility. And I hope that they are not making that mistake.
How do you think this announcement of a withdrawal will impact your negotiations with the Taliban?
Circumstances when these sorts of situations takes place, and one side which thinks that because of the vacuum that the withdrawal leaves, it may be able to take advantage of that situation, that emboldens the position of the sides. The one which is which thinks more on the military term rather than peaceful means, and that's the concern. Taliban position might be further emboldened. Well, as far as the excuses or the reasons that they were giving, that it's because of the presence of the international forces, it's jihad against the foreigners and so on and so forth. So in 3 months' time, perhaps even less than 3 months' time, there will be no foreign troops in our soil.
What's the status of Doha negotiations? They seem to have stalled.
Recently, with the announcement of the withdrawal, before September 11. The Taliban position has changed. They say that they have gone to their chief negotiator, has gone to Pakistan to consult with their leaders and to take directions from them, to take instruction about it, to shape up their position. What they would do from today onwards, which is 1st of May, because earlier their position was that we were going to attack the international forces. So as far as Doha process is concerned, we still believe that it's important, and also other opportunities like Turkey, the meeting in Turkey. Of course, it has to be a meaningful event. Both sides need to work beforehand in order to make it more effective.
You mentioned the Turkey conference, the Istanbul conference as it's known. The Taliban are refusing to come. So, A, why are they refusing to come? And do you think even after Eid, if they don't come, there will be an Istanbul conference?
Well, if they don't come to a meeting which is supposed to be between both sides and supported by the international community, of course, this will be a new situation. The conference will not take place. They haven't said that they are not coming. They haven't said that they are coming. That has been the difficulty in negotiating with the Taliban throughout. They leave their position very vague. They give different impressions to different different interlocutors. As a result of such an attitude, the time in Doha was not best utilized.
That was VOA Pakistan and Afghanistan Bureau Chief Aisha Tanzim speaking with the chair of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah. Taliban insurgents in Afghanistan assaulted and overran a key army base in southeastern Ghazni province Saturday, capturing dozens of soldiers and killing several others. Ayaz Gul is in Islamabad, and he gave me the details about the ongoing violence and the outcome of multinational talks about the situation in Afghanistan.
What we understand from statements issued by both sides in the last 24 hours, including Sunday, is that there have been fighting clashes in different parts of the country, particularly in southern Afghanistan, which has been the stronghold for the Taliban when they were in control of the country. So there were clashes, deadly clashes, killings are happening again. And that's what, everybody is really worried about, that with this withdrawal of international forces taking place, there's going to be more fighting.
Ayaz, what can you tell us about the state of intra-Afghan talks? Because not long ago, there was a multinational meeting that released a Troika statement trying to get both sides back to the negotiation table.
Well, that meeting in Doha, Qatar, was very significant, and that clearly indicated that how worried Afghanistan's neighboring country, regional countries, and the United States are. Because now with the withdrawal of foreign troops, United States and NATO forces from Afghanistan, that is the major concern, that if fighting continues, there is continued instability in Afghanistan, it will have serious consequences and implications for regional countries. And that was the reason that these last ditch efforts that are being made, diplomatic efforts to really help the two sides or persuade the two sides to come back to the negotiating table and come agree on some kind of a peace deal that would at least stop this fighting while they discuss a power sharing agreement. And that was the whole purpose of this Troika meeting, which was where U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad and his Russian, Pakistani and Chinese counterparts collectively met Taliban leaders and urged them to really soften their position, because it's not right now the Afghan government and its negotiating team, it's the Taliban, which is apparently not showing any flexibility in its stance to really bring down the violence and come to the negotiating table, because Taliban have consistently maintained that any progress in the negotiations will be possible once all foreign troops leave Afghanistan. So what we expect is that we will see more fighting in coming months, and that seems to be their strategy to make sure that all foreign troops withdraw by September 11th, as President Joe Biden has announced. And then we may expect some kind of a breakthrough in these political negotiations. And the reason there's a lot of pressure on the Taliban from regional countries, from Pakistan especially, where we know that Taliban leaders and their families have lived for long among Afghan refugees. And Pakistan is really under pressure, not only from regional countries, but from the United States, to really use its leverage over the Taliban and persuade them to negotiate some kind of a peace understanding to help end this 4 decades of hostilities and bloodshed in Afghanistan.
You mentioned pressure, but has there been any discussions as to how that pressure may be manifest by regional governments?
Well, the demands from Pakistan has been both from the Afghan government and the United States that they should really prevent Taliban from using Pakistani soil to direct attacks inside Afghanistan. But let me tell you, Steve, the Taliban right now, militarily, are having an upper hand in the battlefield. And with this sense of achievement, you know, if you talk to the Taliban leaders, that's what we have been talking to them, they have this kind of sense of achievement that they have been able to defeat, as they say, the world's only superpower and the United States and its allies with so much modern military equipment and technology, that they have finally forced these international forces to leave Afghanistan. So, you know, whatever pressure that is going to be applied to the Taliban, whether it's Pakistan or Iran, which also shares a long border with Afghanistan and has lately increased its contact with the Taliban, it will be very difficult for any external actor now to press the Taliban to negotiate a peace in a way that the current political system or the government of President Ashraf Ghani is also in power in Kabul, and then the Taliban negotiate a peace will simply be out of question, because they have always also clearly conveyed to the United States and other countries that they don't want this political governance system in Afghanistan that has come into existence after the invasion of Afghanistan 20 years ago by international forces. They want some changes in the constitution. They want a new system that they say is called some kind of an Islamic system, but they have not really clearly stated what do they mean by that. And that is why there is a lot of confusion. Even there was confusion when the talks were happening between the Afghan government and the Taliban. That is where the problem lies right now. And the Taliban continuously, they are refusing to negotiate any kind of a permanent deal with the current government in Kabul.
Ayaz Ghul spoke to me from Islamabad. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. On Sunday, Myanmar police detained people in Yangon. It was one of the largest protests in recent days, with security forces once again opening fire on protesters, killing at least 7, according to local media. Now, to get further details, as the country enters its 4th month of protests opposing the February 1st coup, I spoke with reporter Kate Diamond in Yangon.
The last week of April, youth tried to organize people to get back in the street, you know, firstly as a flash mob movement, because the security forces are everywhere. You know, they can be arrested, they can be shot anytime. So they decided to make it as the flash mob movement. So it was like successful. So they have done, you know, at least three days, like in a week, in different places, you know, at the end of April, like the last week of April. And then there was a call, you know, to have the Spring Revolution days, you know, like across the world. So it's not just in Yangon, it's not just in Myanmar, but also the whole, you know, like across the globe, there's we call it, you know, Global Spring Revolution Day, which is May 2nd. So today people, people were in the street, you know, of course, still the flash mob, but hundreds of people, you know, mostly youth calling for the federal democracy. And this is the very clear that they are defying the military junta in every possible way that they can do.
Cape, according to local media, there have been some 11 explosions over the last 36 hours or so, mostly in Yangon. What can you tell us about that development and whether or not there have been any casualties as a result?
Last night, which is in the evening of May 1st, you know, we also received the report of some casualties from the explosion in Yangon. But so far for today, I do not hear any casualties report, you know, from the explosion for today.
There are media reports, local media reports of two people being killed in Wetlet, also some other people being killed in other towns in the Shan State, as well as another area, according to the Kachin News Group. Can you confirm what you have heard in terms of protests and deadly encounters elsewhere in Myanmar?
Yeah, so far these are the places that we've been notified or we've been heard that, you know, of course, the casualties and death report. And at the same time, I guess there may be more casualty that we haven't been able to look at because of the internet shutdown and also because of the mobile signal. So the communication here is getting worse and difficult. As you know, that you know that the mobile internet being shut down since the merge, and of course the curfew style nightly internet shutdown. But of course the curfew style nightly internet shutdown was lifted a few days ago, so there's no like night internet shutdown. But at the same time, we are only using the internet, like fiber internet at home. So there's no public Wi-Fi outside. There's no mobile data. So it is really hard to get the news out from those small towns. So it's really hard, you know, to get the news out. And also the mobile signals are not really safe and the mobile signals are not really strong. So sometimes we are struggling to get the news out from those small towns.
Reporter Cape Diamond in Yangon, Myanmar. The UN Human Rights Office condemns the deadly use of force by Chad security forces against peaceful protesters demanding a return to civilian rule. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Nationwide demonstrations throughout the past week have been met with a fierce response by Chad's defense and security forces, who reportedly killed six people on Tuesday and wounded several others. The UN Human Rights Office expresses grave concern at this excessive, disproportionate use of force, including the use of live ammunition against peaceful protesters. In addition, UN Human Rights spokeswoman Marta Hurtado says 700 people reportedly have been arrested. She says those actions are in violation of international law, which obliges countries to protect and respect human rights, including the right of freedom of peaceful assembly.
The decree imposing a blanket ban on demonstrations without prior authorization may undermine the exercise of the right to peaceful assembly. We also note that the Transitional Military Council itself declared on 20 April that it would abide by Chad international treaty obligations.
Chad's president, Idriss Deby, was killed by rebels on April 20th. Chad's military appointed a transitional military council headed by Deby's son, Mohamed Idriss Deby, until new elections were to be held in 18 months. Hurtado says that decree has elicited an outcry of protest from Chad's political opposition, triggering mass demonstrations against continued military rule.
The people on the street are demanding that the country comes back to the constitutional order and civilian rule. They have been demonstrating, as said, they want the authorities to hear their demands.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on state authorities to conduct impartial, effective, and transparent investigations into human rights violations that may have occurred, including the use of excessive force against protesters. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The coronavirus pandemic continues to pummel India, documenting a new national record Sunday of nearly 3,700 deaths in the past 24 hours and more than 390,000 new infections. While India is home to the world's largest vaccine manufacturer, the Serum Institute of India, only 2% of the country's 1.3 billion people have so far been vaccinated. The country expanded its vaccine eligibility program Saturday to anyone 18 and older. Many locations reported that they did not have any vaccines and blamed the Serum Institute's CEO. The French news agency reports Nigerian Islamist militants have attacked two army bases in the rest of northeast, overrunning one camp and killing at least eight people. Sources told the French press agency that insurgents attacked a base in Nigeria early Sunday morning, about 20 kilometers away from the Borno state capital of Maiduguri, and late Saturday hit a base in Ran in the same state. Islamic State-aligned militants have intensified attacks on army camps in recent weeks as part of a more than a decade-long insurgency that has killed more than 36,000 people. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. North Korea lashed out at the United States and its allies in South Korea on Sunday. Pyongyang issued a series of statements saying recent comments from Washington are proof of a hostile policy that requires a corresponding response. Reuters' Lauren Anthony has more.
The statements put out by state news agency KCNA come after the White House on Friday said U.S. officials had completed a months-long review of North Korean policy. One saw a foreign ministry spokesman accusing Washington of insulting the dignity of the country's supreme leadership by critiquing North Korea's human rights record. The unnamed spokesman added that the remarks show the U.S. is, quote, girding itself up for an all-out showdown with North Korea and will be answered accordingly. In a separate statement, Kwon Jong-un, Director General of the Foreign Ministry's U.S. Affairs Department, cited Biden's first policy speech to Congress on Wednesday. The new president had said nuclear programs in North Korea and Iran posed threats that would be addressed through diplomacy and stern deterrence. Something Kwon branded illogical and an encroachment on North Korea's right to self-defense. He added that U.S. talk of diplomacy is aimed at covering up its hostile acts, and its deterrence is just a means for posing nuclear threats to North Korea. Kwon concluded that North Korea would, quote, be compelled to press for corresponding measures now Biden's policy has become clear, adding that with time the U.S. will find itself in a very grave situation. In a third statement on Sunday, Kim Yo-jong, a senior official in the government and sister of leader Kim Jong-un, sharply criticized South Korea for failing to stop defector activists from producing anti-North Korea leaflets. The White House and State Department did not immediately comment on the North Korean statements.
Lauren Anthony from Reuters News. Thailand's southernmost provinces bordering Malaysia have been the center of an insurgency since 2004. Over 7,000 people have been killed, mostly civilians, caught up in the fighting between shadowy Malay Muslim rebels and Thai security forces. But a new generation is determined to reclaim a space from violence. Wichitra Dundi reports.
At the Risk Pattani Club, nothing gets in the way of skating, not even an insurgency.
Back in the day, there weren't many skaters, but now with the help of social media, more people are into it. Pattani isn't as scary as the media portrays it all these years. Most people who have come here to visit want to come back.
Thailand colonized the Muslim-majority Deep South in 1902. Insurgency against rule by the Buddhist Thai state has flared sporadically since the late 1950s. But it is not a war over religion. Instead, Malay Muslim locals accuse Thai governments of forced assimilation, of crushing unique language and culture, denying them a political voice, and carrying out abuses under the guise of fighting insurgency. Pattani, Yalan, Rathiwad provinces bordering Malaysia and part of Songkhla have been under martial law for 17 years. The zone is a few hours from some of Thailand's most treasured tourist beaches, but it feels a world away, locked off by a reputation for bombs and shootouts and smothered by checkpoints and security forces. Peace talks have drifted for years, and that has left the area stalked by fear of the men with guns. But the violence has slowed to a historic low due to a ceasefire called by the main rebel group during the coronavirus. The economy has picked up with the improving security, allowing cafes and galleries to flourish and public events to be held in safety. At this college-organized marathon, students say they want to banish the reputation of their home as a no-go zone.
I want outsiders to experience Pattani for themselves to find that it's not as dangerous as they think. If you live in the southern provinces, you find that security has been part of life for so long that it's becoming normal.
But the violence does persist. A suspected insurgent was shot and killed by rangers just a few days ago after bomb attacks in Rathiwar. But at this first craft beer bar in the deep south, owner Wasan says society is increasingly liberal and affluent after years of economic stagnation.
Pattani is very open. Be they Muslims, Buddhists or Christians, have long lived together in harmony. There's enough space for everyone to practice what they want, as long as we respect and love each other.
Their lives may be framed by violence, but a new generation is determined not to be defined by it. Flickers of hope from Thailand's forgotten conflict zone. Wititaradungdi for VOA News, Pattani, Thailand.
NASA and SpaceX say that the return to Earth of four astronauts, three Americans and one Japanese from the International Space Station on Sunday brings us even closer to citizen spaceflight to the moon and even to Mars one day. AP correspondent Julie Walker has more.
SpaceX's Dragon capsule splashed down off the coast of Florida just before 3 a.m., ending the second astronaut flight for Elon Musk's company. Representative Hans Konigsmann.
The SpaceX and NASA teams returned human spaceflight back to the United States, and I think this is a remarkable achievement, the opportunity of a lifetime.
He says they're looking forward to many more flights
to the space station and beyond Moon and Mars.
NASA's Kathy Leader says they're on board.
Our goal is one day that everyone's a space person, and so this is just an exciting first step for that.
Dragon capsule was the same one that took the astronauts in November, and the splashdown was the first U.S. in darkness since the Apollo 8 moonshot. I'm Julie Walker.
Today is World Press Freedom Day, and to mark the occasion, the U.S. Agency for Global Media is hosting its second annual Press Freedom Film Festival. It's being held online May 3rd through the 14th, and will feature documentaries from USAGM's five public service broadcasting networks, of which VOA is one. The goal of the festival is to illustrate the importance of press freedom around the world by showing a collection of films that will provide audiences with a look inside at the media environments in which USAGM networks operate and the challenges they face reporting, often in media repressive regions.
It's a nation forged from the ruins of a fallen empire. A once poor country that in the early 2000s rose to become an economic success story. And whose leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, inspired hope.
He came to power saying he respected democracy.
Yet during his nearly two-decade rule, Erdogan has repeatedly attacked one of democracy's bedrock principles, freedom of the press.
Now, the first film in the series is from VOA, and it's entitled Turkey, Breaking the Silence, and looks at how press freedom has eroded during the past two decades under Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The film is currently available on our own website. Just click on the Press Freedom tab. But every film will be screened online at 2300 UTC. And for more information on how to view all of them for free, visit usagm.gov for details. Well, this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. And on behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. And to stay up to date with world news and events, be sure to point your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.